Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Amy and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we will believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problem that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight, he's been sober all my life, so I give you Phil.
I'm Phil Moore and I'm an alcoholic. And, I tell you what, I ought to get the truth out of the way first, I guess. My sobriety date is February the 12th, 1988, and I just celebrated 31 years of sobriety through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am eternally grateful for that. I got here young, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really not old now. Y'all might think I am, but I'm not. I don't know. My wife will tell you, that's her. I left this weekend to go to a memorial for a friend of mine. He had 35 years when he passed. And we had a memorial up in Dahlonegan. My old sponsor and some of us that got sober together met up and spent the night in the cabin. And it's funny, my old sponsor, Cliff, he's a character. I mean, he was a character. He got about 36 years. But he's starting to have some physical problems, and he's getting dementia and stuff, and it's really sad, really hard. You know, it's really sad for me to see that. He shared so much of his life with me and helped me so much, and then I've been talking to him. I've got every sponsor I've ever had. I hate to tell you all that. They just die off, but I ain't never fired a sponsor. He was my first sponsor, and my second sponsor was Roop, and my third sponsor was Jack B, who his sponsor made him get me as his sponsor when he was dying on his bed, and I kept Jack till I got Chris B, who's my sponsor now, and I still talk to all of them except for Roop, and I just talk to him in prayer. Y'all might know Roop, I don't know, but anyway, so I'm a little bit. When Tim gave me the email, I thought I missed it or something, because he'd asked me to do this one time, and I thought I'd missed it. And then I was really pumped because I was going to see my people and all that this weekend, and then I come back and I was just kind of drained, been down all day, you know, about it. It really upset me. I didn't realize how bad it upset me till I really saw him in his element and how far he had progressed. It's hard to tell on the phone sometimes, but when you get around somebody in person, it's easy to see. But but all in that, you know, we are people. You got to admit now, we are people who have if you stay here, I mean, you had a hell of a life, two lives. I had two lives. I'm still on my second one. I hope I don't have three. But I've had two lives, and both have been enlightening. I'll put it that way. Both lives have been, and all the people. And I still see all. I mean, I'm a person that, I mean, from the gate out, I don't know if I think I was alcoholic from the gate, just waiting on a drink. I had a lot of childhood trauma, but I don't think that had a lot to do with my alcoholism. But because I loved it from the get-go. My first drink that I remember was I had an uncle, and I just loved him to death. I thought he walked on water. He rode motorcycles, stayed piled up in bed drunk, wouldn't go to work. And I just thought he hung the moon. I really did as a little kid. And we was all going over to my grandmother's birthday party, which was Christmas Eve. That's her birthday. And I was about 5 years old, and I was hanging over at my uncle's house. And he was pouring him a big, tall tumbler of bourbon. And he had filled it up in a little Coke in and handed it down there to me and let me knock the top off of it. And I tried to kill it every time I could. And the only thing I remember about that night was trying to take sips off that tumbler. And then I remember standing up in that old 65 Falcon, standing in the front seat, riding over to my grandmother's, because I could still stand in the front seat. We didn't use seat belts or nothing like that. I don't know how y'all were when I was growing up. I used to sit sleep in the back of the station wagon, been thrown all the way to the front and hit the damn dashboards, and they were metal back then. Kids just weak now. They just can't take it, you know. I mean, I don't understand it. Back, we got thrown all over everywhere. But, anywho, I forgot what I said. Yo, what was it? Huh?
Tommy?
Oh, yeah, and going over there, and then they said that I was drunk, and they had to hide me from my grandmama and all that stuff, and I don't remember a thing about it. Didn't set off a craving. I woke up. I know that she woke me up at his house in the yard the next day. That's all I know about it. And I couldn't wait to do it again, you know. I couldn't wait to do it again. And I did. We grew up, and we used to camp out. And, you know, I grew up with Baptists and Methodists and all. It was, you know, I grew up before divorces were cool and shit like that. But we used to go around and raid the houses on the weekend, and we knew what everybody drank, you know. Because Baptists, you know, and Methodists, they kept their liquor out in the car porch in the storage room. They didn't keep it in the house back then. And all us kids, we knew exactly everybody where. So we just picked, y'all want to drink liquor tonight or you want to drink beer? We go to the Martins or we go to the Bentleys, whichever one you want to hit. And we'd get drunk and chase cars, get naked and chase cars. Don't know what you do when you catch one, but that's what we did. We thought it was fun. It was cool, right? I mean, alcohol was wonderful to me. I thought it was the coolest thing in the world, man. Made me feel, oh, it did. Made me feel powerful, I think. And I think about this because I thought about this story, and the only two times I thought about it was when it happened and when I was in treatment. When I was about 5 years old, I got a Superman suit for Christmas, a real one. I ain't talking about no fake stuff. I'm talking about with the cape, the S, the shirt, the pants, the whole nine yards. And I'll never forget it, because we'd been, you know, like everybody else, common folks. We tied towels with pins around our necks and flew around the yards and fought and wrestled. And I got me a real suit, and I was going to climb up on the porch, and I was going to fly around the neighborhood and show everybody how bulletproof I was. I put that suit on, boy. I climbed up off that rail, and I dove. And I hit the ground. Bam! And I was humiliated, embarrassed, and I'll never forget Belva, neighbor next door. She was with Mama, and she picked up the thing. Of course, later I found where it said machine washable. She said, "This suit will not make you fly." I took that suit off. I never wore it again, ever. I didn't think about that until I was in treatment. That was like my alcoholism was. Every time I took a drink, it's like standing on that front porch, standing there fixing to go. And many, many days I'd wake up feeling humiliated and embarrassed. But I did not put that suit on again. I put it on again every day, trying to get there. Now, I didn't start drinking in the mornings out of necessity. I started drinking in the mornings at 15 years old. Just before my 16th birthday, me and a buddy robbed, burglarized a beer store and stole 96 cases of beer. Well, I don't know about y'all and y'all's alcoholism, but mine, when you're 15 years old and you got 96 cases of beer, you start drinking in the morning. And I did. And I don't know when I crossed the line, but I never not drank in the morning. I never not started my day off drinking. And that was to go on till I got sober and at 30 years old. And when I got and I'll just qualify just a little bit. I got 14 DUIs, and I hardly ever got caught drinking and driving. Hardly ever got caught drinking and driving. Because I do not ever remember I took my test drinking. I don't ever remember being in a car driving it that I wasn't drinking or wasn't under the influence, so I hardly ever got caught drinking and driving. I'd have got caught twice in 24 hours, but that was their fault for letting me out. It was not my fault. I got caught on Thanksgiving Day and the day after. Same bondsman I had, it was DUI number 4 and 5, and the first night scared the police. Of course, you know how it is. I was about maybe from here. That's Jeff Johnny out there from the house. You know how we are. And the cop pulls me over, and I was wore out. So when I finally got, I couldn't walk. I just barely get around. I finally eased over, and he had the blue lights flashing, doing his thing, whatever they do. I just got out and walked up to the back door and opened it to get in. He jumped out with a damn gun. I mean, you thought I was fixing to commit murder or something. And I was like, he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I was like, look, buddy, listen, I'm too tired to argue. Just let me lay down. Let's go. He took me on to jail, and then I got bonded out by a bondsman, and damn, if I didn't get a DUI almost in the same place the next day after I got out. Matter of fact, the same people on jail were coming back in for shift when I got there. And they was like, deja vu, wasn't you just in here? I said, yeah. I called a bail bondsman, and I said, sir, can you come get me out of jail? He said, this is DUI number 5. You're a habitual violator. He said, I just got you out of jail. Are you out of your mind? I said, the fact that I'm back in jail or tell you I'm good for it. I mean, hell, I'm right here. Where am I going? You know? And, of course, he wouldn't make bond. But I did eventually get bond. And, but for me, I mean, I loved everything about drinking. It just did something for me. It made me instantly okay. And most of my drinking career, I drank round the clock. I never considered myself a drunk or anything like that. I mean, there were times it got out of hand. Now, towards the end, it got real bad. The last 5 years of my drinking, I got up every day puking and gagging, trying to get a drink down to get through another day. And of course, you know, like a lot of young people, I learned better living through chemistry early on in my life. And that got me a lot of trouble. I went, got busted, went to prison in 79, 70-something, I don't know, for a couple pounds of MDA. I think they call it ecstasy today. But they wasn't real cool about that, and they put me in jail for that. And I did good. I kept getting my parole retarded for buck, making drink, and I started selling drugs in jail because I was in North Carolina, Butner, North Carolina, a federal institution there, and they put me on a work run, and I'd never had a visitor or anything in the whole time I was in, and they locked me up in the carpentry shop to make, because they wouldn't let me go outside the gate because I'd got in trouble in the other institution I was in. And anyway, so I didn't know what to do in there, so I started making stuff. I started making picture frames and, and clipboards and stuff with stash holes in them and stuff. And I started trading and selling that stuff. And I got kicked out of the carpenter shop because I had cut up something like $10,000 worth of material and made it all into frames and boxes and stuff and sold it while I was supposed to be in there watching the shop. They didn't like that, but anyway. But I never thought, and one thing about alcoholism, me, you know, I never thought I had a problem. I mean, I love to drink, you know, and they talk about alcoholism, you know, the book says that when you want to, you cannot stop entirely, or when you drink more than you intend to. Well, I know that many, many times I'd get locked up, and I would swear to God I ain't never drinking again. Then I'd make bond. And, you know, you just change your mind. When I got to alcoholics, that's what I thought I did. I just changed my mind. I was going to quit, but I ain't now. You know, and I kept doing that over and over. Nobody told me that might be alcoholism. I didn't know. I said, well, the only reason I'm drinking now is because I want to. You know. But I did that over and over and over and over. I just changed my mind. And the reason was because I was just like the book says, I could not conceive. I could not imagine life without alcohol. Could not imagine it during those early years. Could not imagine. Why would you quit? Why? Even with the trouble. I mean, I started getting in trouble from the gate. From age 14 to 30, I was either paying off some lawyer, some probation department, some judge, some something, wrecked car, something due to my drinking. And I thought, you know, I just can't get a break. Just can't get a break. I never understood it. I just could not understand it. And with a lot of us, you know, it takes what it takes. It took every drink I ever drank to get here. And I know in Alcoholics Anonymous you hear a lot of people say, you know, it's a choice today. It is not a choice for me. It is not a choice for me. I do not have a choice. I cannot not drink no matter what I say, bet, promise, do. It don't make no damn difference. What I do have a choice in is that if I want to stay sober, I'll have to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of y'all don't have to. And that's fine. I'm just speaking for me. Because I am powerless over alcohol. That means I can't fix it. I can't stop it. I can't keep from drinking it. I can't do anything with it. You know, there's nothing I can do with it. I can't even keep it out myself from drinking it. See, y'all may can, but I never could. I never could. I could guarantee, I could bet everything, bet the whole farm I'll never take another drink. Something will change my mind in 30 minutes somewhere down the road, and I'll just change my mind. That's alcoholism. That's not free will. That's alcoholism. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 30 years old, and I was a complete failure in every area of my life. I was unemployable. I couldn't hold a job. I didn't want to work. I really didn't want to be threatened with a job. And I years before I got sober, I would work for peace of mind. I did not work for money. I worked for peace of mind. I had more money than I needed to work, but I'd get so out there, I'd get so damn crazy that I'd go to work with some guys. I'm a carpenter. I've been slinging hammers my whole life. I ain't got no training. and I would go to work for peace of mind. Towards the end of my drinking, I got a job with an old buddy of mine that didn't allow you to drink on a job. Prior to that, first requirement for getting a job was you was able to drink on the job. I started out drinking on the job. Everybody drank on the job back where I was working. The builder drank. The subs worked. Everybody drank on the job. You would have got blackballed if you didn't drink on the job. So I learned it honestly. And that's what attracted me to that profession right off the bat. I knew, oh yeah, this is the kind of work I like, you know. I started out using beer cans in my nail apron, found out that don't work. Cork bottles work a lot better. They don't puncture near as easy. Because you will puncture your cans if you keep them in your nail apron. But for me, it did. Towards the end, I had my brother and I, boy, we were... I guess we've been called white trash, hoodlums, some of that kind of stuff. But we wasn't no worse than nobody else we run with. They was all hoodlums. My brother, God rest his soul, he succumbed to the disease 2 years before I got sober. His last words to me was, "Phil, I think I'm going to die." My last words to him were, "It won't be no great loss." And I went out to relieve myself off of the porch, and he blew a hole in his heart and withdrawals from alcohol, and he died. And I fell off the porch, shattered my dang ankle. I got a artificial ankle now, but that was years later when I had it replaced. But I shattered it, ended up calling the ambulance, went to the hospital. They didn't want to tell me that my brother had died. And I was in a hospital and the doing surgery. And the only instructions my doctor gave was give him all the Valium and phenobarbital to detox him that you can, and don't let him out till his brother's in the ground. And that's all they did. They kept me till he was buried, and after he was buried, they let me out. Because I had said something in the surgery that freaked him out. I don't know what that was, but it freaked him out enough to tell him to say. The reason I know that is because a guy I sponsor, nurse that was in the surgery, lives across the street, was in there when it happened. And but one of the things about that is I got released, and this sickness of alcoholism, boy, you know, your brother just dies, I get released, the girl I'm with takes me home, she's feeling awful remorseful and bad about everything that's happening. She gets all dressed up to go to church that night. Me, first, I got out, I went by and got my pain medication filled. I went over there, I was going to try to do right, but she got all dressed up to go out, and I thought, hell, she's going out on the town. She said she's going to church. Made me mad. I called a buddy of mine, told him, bring me a bottle of liquor. I was getting the hell out of here. I was going back where my brother died, because that was home, and I didn't want to be around nobody having parties. And he did, and I left, and I'll never forget it. In the middle of the night, I got sober. I had a spiritual experience, and it was the presence of my brother. Of course, I didn't see it. It was just a feeling. Felt like I was stone cold sober. Said, "Live as I live, and you'll die as I die, and it's all for nothing." That was it. My daddy called me at 6 a.m. in the morning crying, saying, "I don't want to go to no more funerals. Please do something. Please do something." I made it for 2.5 more years. Hard. I went at it hard, hard for 2.5 more years. And I ended up with a stroke and withdrawals at Gwinnett Medical Center. And that started my journey. An Alcoholics Anonymous. I was, they tried to talk me into going to treatment and all that stuff, and I wasn't hearing it. And this little lady named Angela Hagen was a social worker. She's retired now from Gainesville. She came into my room after I'd done cussed every doctor out and all this foolishness, and she said, "I know a place that might could help you." And she remembered my brother. And I used to take my brother and all our cronies went down to GMHI. We'd take them down to GMHI when it got too bad drinking they were drinking English leather one time. Because you get all kind of colors when you drink English leather. The colors are really nice. I promise you they are. They're really nice. But I'd always, we'd cart them down there to sober up and usually pick up two or three on the way back. We've done that several times. But she said, I remember your brother. And I tried to help him. And for some reason, God moved on me. And I did not want to hurt her feelings for some reason. I just didn't. I just told her what she wanted to hear. I said, yeah. She said, if I could get you in a place, would you go? I said, yeah. And knowing, I had already made the phone call for somebody to come get me out of there. And the old ambulance come rolling in, paramedics. That guy running the paramedics ended up being my GSR at my home group. I didn't know that at the time. But he come in, whoa, reeling in to get me in the ambulance, and I throwed my radio on the gurney, and I had a half bottle of liquid codeine. I drank it while I was in the hospital just for case I was going to get where I couldn't get nothing. And we went to Buford Treatment Center, you know. Nothing happened, nothing expected. But I'll tell you my moment of clarity. I was in that nut house, and I guess I'd been in there a couple of weeks. I don't know, really don't know. And I heard old boy down in the AA meeting, first words I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, the old boy said, "My mind is out to get my ass." I don't know, don't mean nothing to y'all. Light bulb went off on me. And I went back. I was back in my room. Now, I'm in treatment. I've been turned down by every halfway house. I'm getting close to getting out. No halfway house in Atlanta area or surrounding area will take me because of my record in jail. And so I'm getting irritated. And I go back to my room, and I had this moment of clarity. And the moment of clarity was that I remember getting out of prison, and this is what I had going on me when I was getting out of prison. I was getting out of prison. I had a job. I was going to get married. I was going to start a business. I could go to work here. I was getting married, and I was just going to start a business. Well, I was coming home, and the bus, Greyhound bus, I had to beat the parole off, federal parole office the next morning. Bus come through Knoxville, Tennessee, and had a 15-minute layover, and I had done everything to sober up in there to make it out for the last 6 months. I hadn't had a thing to drink, and I caught a neon sign out of the corner of my eye, and I ran over there and bought me two beers and killed them, and I bought four more and put them in my overalls and got on that bus and come on to Atlanta. Nothing happened. I did not get married. I did not start a business, and I did not go to work. And boy, when I came out, I was fighting way too. I had a 45-inch chest, 15-inch arms, and 32-inch waist. I was fighting way, boy. It wasn't 6 months. How that done dropped down here like this again. I done got drinking, and it went away quick. I worked hard on that, too. But I lost all that. And it was a trip. My brother, I got to say a little about my brother because he didn't make it. And he was the type of guy that was funny. I'll never forget the first car he ever paid off that they didn't repossess. It was a Buick Skylark. 67 Buick Skylark, and we offered it to the gods down at Lake Lanier on the river. We set that bitch afire, let it up to the gods because it was the only thing he'd ever paid for his whole life completely. Makes sense, don't it? Doesn't make sense to me. And it was a good sacrifice. But when I hit my bottom, it was that 2 years when he died, I felt so sorry for myself, and I just kept going in the hole, in the rabbit hole, deeper and deeper and deeper. The year before I got sober, that August, I think Dennis came over and got me and took me to a race, because I didn't come out in the daytime, you know, like Pulp Fiction. I had one of them house coats. I got up 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and went and checked the mail. That's about the only sunlight I got. And he picked me out one day and went to races. I got third-degree burns all over me. I hadn't been out in the damn sun so long, I lit up like a damn firecracker. Just burnt me slap up. And, but my last bench, like I said, I got sober February the 12th, 1988. And if y'all don't remember, that was the day after New Year's. I went in a blackout Christmas. I went by and told my parents. I went by to see them. And I was drunk, shooting cocaine. Went in there and told them what I thought about all their Christmas ideas and how bullshit it was, and it was just putting on airs and all this stuff. And the next time I come to, it was February. I was in that nut house, that hospital in February. I'd had 3 grandma seizures. I had been on a death run, and I had pneumonia. I got cirrhosis of the liver. My liver's shot. It's shot to this day. There ain't nothing left of it. I had my last biopsy about 3 years ago. Tried it twice. Broke the needle both times. They'll never do another biopsy on me. There ain't nothing there. Stick with needle in. But I'm sober now, Alcoholics Anonymous, and living good. Living. Don't need it if you don't drink. Don't much. Don't need much of it. And that, you know, I come here, though, and what it was for me, I didn't know if I had a desire to stop drinking. I really did not know. What I did have a desire for was pain to stop. Because what happened to me is that self-centered fear, I couldn't drink it away anymore. No matter how much dope I did, how much alcohol I drank every single day, I could not drink it away. I'd be sitting, I'd be trying to drink, have a good time, and I'd be, you know, I'm going to sit here and drink a few, and I'm going to enjoy it. And I'd always go in a damn blackout. Come back, I'd be sitting there, I'm going to sit here and just drink these few beers, and I'm chill. And I'd start, hell, I'd come too, might be the next day, and I'd be in the same chair. Them beers wouldn't be there. I'd be pissed all in my damn britches, and people tell me all the damn places I went. And no, I could not. And then what would happen was when people around and drinking, I would go in there. I couldn't communicate anymore. I didn't have anything to say to anybody. I didn't have nothing for nobody anymore. And I was just afraid on the inside. And I got... I had got on a run had pneumonia, so I was trying not to drink. I know it's Alcoholics Anonymous, so I bought me an ounce of crank. And I started shooting crank so I wouldn't have to drink. I ended up in the hospital with withdrawals from alcohol, trying to shoot crank. Don't work. And they said I was saturated with cocaine and crank and opiates, a lot of opiates. I did a lot of that stuff. My last, that like that bottle I had, my mother, it's like a 22-ounce bottle. If you had it, if it was Percocets or lower tabs, it'd probably be about 300 in there. And I drank 2 bottles of it. I drank a bottle of it and put my mama's head through a sheetrock wall for her to call the doctor and tell her she spilt it and order me another one. I did that. And I ended up going into withdrawals. I started hallucinating, and a girlfriend of mine took me and dropped me off at the hospital and left. And my blood pressure was 200 over 200, and I was having a mild stroke, and that started the journey. And then, now I'm going to tell you something, that moment of clarity that I had, I knew when I went back to that room and that guy had said that, an oath about that thought about Knoxville, Kentucky, I knew that I was going to drink again, and there was nothing I could do about it. Absolutely nothing. Because I had thought about all that. I had people pulling for me. I was going to get married, start a job, do all. I had people pulling for me, sweating everything on the line. I caught one Neon sign. Changed it all. Didn't happen instantly, but it changed instantly. I mean, it changed. And I fell to my knees, and I said, God, I don't know who you are or what you are, but I need help. Didn't get no bolt of lightning. Nothing happened. But I haven't had a drink since. I've been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous since. And I want to tell you something. I made that big surrender right then. Nothing happened. Right? Nothing happened. I got out. I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. First day I got out, guy pulled up in Miami and threw a kilo of cocaine on my table and said, I heard you about died. Here, get yourself back right. Get you some money and get back right. You'll be all right. And I said no. First time in my life, I said no. And I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I've been going ever since. And I'm going to tell you, I'm a person that cannot not drink no matter what I say, bet, promise. It don't make a shit. Whatever I tell you. I ain't had a drink since. And I haven't wanted a drink. And I don't know why that happened. See, that has to come from something outside of me. Because if the book says if a better code of morals, a better philosophy of life, if better thinking, better acting, better any damn thing would do it, hell, we wouldn't be here. We'd fix ourselves and go on. This ain't a place you fix yourself. This is a place you allow to get fixed. All you got to do, and then when I found out that getting sober didn't have a damn thing to do with me, oh man, I lit into this shit like it was going out of style. I found out that it has nothing to do with me. I don't have to be smart. I don't have to understand it. I don't have to read it right. I don't have to do shit. All I got to do is be willing to work the steps. I got to be willing to see if I'm powerless. Am I really powerless? If I am, is there a power that can restore me to sanity? Can it happen? You think it happened? I said, hell no, it won't happen for me. Ain't no way God gonna do anything for me. Well, poor boy Rice gave me a message, said you didn't have to get good to get God. You need to get God to get out of the hell you're in. I understand that. Hey, I get that. When I found out God meets me where I am and not where I think I ought to be, I like that. That means he can take a screwed up mess and do something with it. As long as I think I got to do something to get that, I ain't going to get it. Because I can't. See, it don't work that way. It's about me continually surrendering to this power greater than my, and on a daily basis, finding out and being aware of what the hell I'm powerless over and what I ain't. I'll guarantee you, if you'll look, you'll find out that 90% of the stuff that caused you the most aggravation in your life, you can't do nothing about it. I'll bet you. And if I stopped concentrating on all the stuff I can't do nothing about, and I start focusing on what's in front of me, life gets a hell of a lot easier. A lot easier. If I can put off worrying about stuff I'm supposed to worry about at 5 o'clock till 5 o'clock, my life goes good. This program tells me how to do that. It tells me how to plug into a power greater than myself. It says, let go and let God. Don't say, get God to do what you want. It says, let go of it. Leave it alone. Let go of it. Hell, if I can fix it, what I need God for? Right? It's continually finding this power that is my source. And man, I'm going to tell you what, once you find that crap out, it gets good. It gets real good. I promise you, I can do anything anybody can do other than take a drink. I guarantee you, I can do anything. I can experience anything. If I'm willing to suffer the consequences, I can do anything without taking a drink. And the cool thing is that life gets pretty damn good. You think about all the personalities and the people that you know. And do you know that They say if a man dies and he can count his true friends on one hand, if he can count three true friends in his life, he's lived a rich life. I can't count them on my hands and toes. I'm talking about people that come to rescue me and my wife. I've married, my second child was coming along. I met my wife in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, bless her heart. She survived, we've survived 22 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got two kids, one's about to graduate from college and the other one's about to earn a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they've never seen me drink, or her. And that's a miracle, Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't keep them from drinking. Didn't break the chain. I used to hear that all the time. They break the chain. Hell, if I could have damn broke the chain, I wouldn't be in AA. You know? What I think is I am real grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is here just the way it is, should they ever need it. Should they ever need it. And it took me 16 years to grace the doors of a church after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hair used to raise up on the back of my neck every time I went in one. Had nothing to do with churches. Had to do with my hearing. My kids started growing up, and I figured, by God, I didn't have what I necessary to give them. Just because I had found what I had found didn't mean I could transfer it to them. Yes, they could see me live, and they know that. But they didn't know anything about a power grade. And so I thought, well, hell, church is pretty good. Good place to raise kids. I got involved. Spent 10 years or so teaching Sunday schools. Loved it. Loved it. They quit going. Hell, I quit going. I don't know. I ain't quit going AA. There's a big difference than being in Alcoholics Anonymous and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did treatment for 10 years, and all the questions I'd always ask the people coming in treatment, I'd ask them about their experience with AA. Tell me about AA. What do you think about AA? How's it work? I can tell you hundreds and hundreds of people that have been through Alcoholics Anonymous, through treatment many times in their life, and don't know one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one. Not one thing, other than you go to some meetings. This is the least of Alcoholics Anonymous right here in this meeting hall. I promise you that. The work is one-on-one. It's one drunk helping another. It's one drunk helping another, learning how to turn it over, that there's a source that will help you, will solve your damn problems, and you can learn to live by and depend on. It's personal to you. Not me, you. I'm to help the man find through the steps that hopefully he'll find a power greater than himself that's personal to him. Not my power, not my higher power, his higher power. And that, it's a miracle. It's just a damn miracle. It's happening all the time. It's always happening. And what I've been guilty of in the last few years, and I've done it over and over in AA, I'm just as sorry as the rest of you. I get to resting on my laurels and get to going to AA meetings and get to not sharing a lot and sitting around. Because I don't know how y'all are. You get some time around, you get in your home group and it's small, people get around, you get to sharing a few times and they think, oh, that was profound. You know, and get putting you up on a pedestal, and I don't want to be on no damn pedestal because I'm going to fall off. And then I get all swelled up and quit sharing. Then I suffer bad, you know. So I'm just coming out of one of those things. So I went by to Gwinnett room the other night and I shared, see if I couldn't. God got me up two new pigeons. One of them's living in the parking lot. And, you know, I just love the hell out of it. Probably won't stay sober, but damn sure help me. I told him, he said, I ain't got no clothes. I said, let me see if my wife, she likes to go to Goodwill. Went home, told Amy, had a drunk over there, probably need a few things. We got in the damn biggest knock-down drag-out. I said, hell, give him a short pair of t-shirts. What about a pillow? Next thing I know, I come back, bring him the homeless guy up there to the room. I bring him a suitcase. This guy, he ain't got no place to put it. With a pillow and all this stuff in it. And I said, hell, throw the pillow away when it gets dirty. I said, that's ain't. We fight. I said, Amy, let's just do one thing today and do something tomorrow. It might not last that long. But I said, hell, we fighting like hell, arguing about I'd help somebody. I said, I should have never told you. You know, but that's, and I got to thinking about it. How fun, how silly is it? Because my idea is, say, I'll help a guy out. I ain't going to give you too much. I'm going to make you work for it. She's like, she's going to put him in a feather bed. I said, he ain't never going to get sober like that. I'm going to cut it. I just want to say that I am absolutely blessed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. It's a gift. And I don't want to give it back. Thank you.
Thank you. That was awesome. I've asked Julie to come up and pass out the chips.
I'm Julie and I'm an alcoholic. That was wonderful. Thank you very much. We have a chip system here at this speaker meeting, and it goes like this. We have a white chip for anybody who wants to start our way of life or for the first time or is coming back. All right. Yay! Anybody else? We have a silver chip for 30 days.
Oh, look at this.
All right. Anybody else for 30 days? How about 60 days? Yeah. Anybody else for 60? How about 90 days? 6 months? 9 months? Any years that I don't know about? How about the year that we do know about?
Thank you.
Okay, tell us who you are.
Okay, my name's Julie. This is my second year.
All right. Yay!
I've pretty much was just tired of being disappointed with my life. I asked God to help me, and he sat me down for quite a bit of time, and I had a lot of time to think, and when I got out, I just chose that this is what I want to do. So I can't go back to where I was, so I'm here, and we're going to keep going.
My name's Amy, and I'm an alcoholic. This is my other half. But I have seen him struggle. I've seen him do good. I've seen him work the program. And he constantly works with newcomers. And I'm proud of you, babe.
Thank you. I'm just cornbread and another drunk. I don't sit in here for the speaker meeting. I work with guys downstairs on Monday nights, but the fellow that just spoke, I really can relate to that last few statements that he made, because we do. We get comfortable and then we share, and it's so profound, and we're so foolish. We really are. And this is 13 years, but that don't mean nothing, man. I can still drink tomorrow. You know, people in here think because we got this time that we're all this perfect. Trust me. I make a lot of mistakes in recovery, but there's only one thing that I've done right, and I take a drink. And I try to work with other alcoholics to remind me where I was at. And, you know, anybody, if, you know, the guy that picked up the white chip, man, if I can do it, I promise you can do it. I promise. Just got to get in here, stick to it, get a sponsor, work some steps, and figure out that alcohol was your solution and that you are the problem. So thank y'all.
Congratulations, Wendy and Julie. Does anybody else want to go come into our way of life for a white chip? Anybody? All right, where you go, y'all.
Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speaker tonight.
Love shines.